This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Sit, boo boo, sit, boo boo, sit. Girl,
I that's some bad hat, Harry.
It's a cool thing.
Get any of that?
Not a doctor.
Bye, have a beautiful
frimula.
Hello and welcome to Hunting Seasons, the podcast that dares to binge watch, deep dive and break down a season of television each and every episode. I'm Broderick Gordis, and today we'll be discussing Big Little Lies Season 1. And if you are a regular listener, you might notice straight away, where's Damask Leary? Unfortunately, Damask is extremely busy with her university commitments at the moment, so she can't be here today. But we have a very special guest who has happily stepped in at the last minute to look after that spot for us. That's our good friend, Hannah Dallas. How are you doing today, Hannah?
I'm doing very well. I'm really happy to be here and to talk about this show.
Thank you very much for coming on. Again, you've been on before when we discussed Sharp Objects.
Yes.
And we plan to have you on to do Big Little Lies because there are some creative some creators behind both those shows that cross over. And so there was always the plan to have you on, just Damask as well.
Yes.
And do sort of had the three of us. But with this sort of current arrangement, it's very, very lucky that you've been able to do this for us. So thank you very much. How have you been?
I've been good. I've been busy. I am also a teacher, so I can definitely relate to how Damask might be feeling. I'm in the middle of presenting some pretty amazing planets that my students have.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
They've created planets.
Yeah, they've designed their own planets.
Wow.
They've learned all about the Goldilocks zone, about what a planet needs to sustain life.
There was a second there I was like, what is that? And then
not too close to the sun, not too far away, just right.
The Kellogg's zone.
Yeah, the Kellogg's zone.
Sure.
I've been trying to get to the theatre when I can and see a few films here and there. I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I really enjoyed it. Like, I thought it was a little bit long.
Mm-hmm.
It was less, I guess, a foray into like an alternative history as what some people were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And more of an exploration of midlife crisis and maybe a metaphor for midlife crisis in Hollywood and trying to move through this
transition
that everyone's experiencing with crisis of masculinity and the whole Harvey Weinstein thing. At least that's how I read it anyway.
It just occurred to me it could make a good double bill with Toy Story 4, which has similar themes of like transitioning, like when maybe, midlife crisis or you aren't, can't do the thing you thought you could do in the past or the world's moving past you. That's very interesting, actually. There's been a couple of films like that this year. I saw it as well. I quite liked it too, but I think it helped that I had some warning about sort of the pace of the movie.
Yeah, it wasn't Tarantino in quote unquote until the final moments.
Yeah.
Spoilers, but what you would expect from him in terms of gratuitous violence and that signature style. But I just loved Brad and Leo opposite each other.
Brad and Leo are fantastic. I was talking with a patient of mine.
Yeah.
I can't mention by name, obviously. But I can mention they were like an 80-year-old woman, basically, who loves her movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, what have you seen recently? She said, oh, I went to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I was like, really?
We went to a matinee as well, and there were quite a few elderly people in front of us.
Sure.
Who were not coping by the end.
This person loved it.
Oh, that's awesome.
She loved it. I was so impressed. I was like, have you seen Tarantino stuff before? She's like, nah, never. I was like, okay. And what did you think of the ending? She's like, I got it. I see why people were talking about, you know, very violent and so forth. But I also thought it was kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's it. I was like, not that patronizing. I was just like, that's exactly the right take, I think, on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm getting her. I'm bringing her Pulp Fiction and Inglourious Basterds. Like, you've got to watch these films.
Wait, are you bringing her a DVD?
DVDs,
does she have a DVD
player? I asked,
player?
She does. Do you have Blu-ray?
Well, my grandma doesn't know how to work it.
No, she's got DVD. She was talking about borrowing it. I was like, don't worry, I'll bring it. I've got them. next appointment, they're yours. What else have you been watching?
What else have I been watching? I went and saw a friend of mine, her new play called Golden Shield, which has been put on by MTC.
I also saw this. Thank you for bringing me along to that.
Yeah, my pleasure. So Felicia King, who I went to university with and did a couple of plays with, she's released, or she had one on at the Royal Court in London. That was her first professional debut.
What a bad place to start.
I know. And then she's got MTC, she's got an STC coming up, as well as something at Belvoir Theatre.
So for people who don't know, that's Melbourne Theatre Company and Sydney Theatre Company.
Yes, Melbourne Theatre Company and Sydney Theatre Company. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing to have those all out there by the time you're 25. And I was, really, really impressed with her play.
Very cool. It's an interesting show as well about...
The Great Firewall of China.
Yeah. And like translation is a big theme in this as well.
Hugely.
And like communication.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on in this play. It was very, very intellectually stimulating. Is it still running?
I think it may have finished, but keep your eye out. If you'd like to see it, I wouldn't be surprised if it got a remount somewhere. Yeah.
Very cool. You're a bit of a reality TV fan,
I've got a guest reality check.
Reality check. It's been a while since we had a reality check, actually.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, no, add
the
sound effects. Yep, great.
I'm a latecomer to the whole Survivor thing.
You should tell the story of how you got into Survivor.
So my partner is a mega Survivor fan and some of our friends are huge Survivor fans as well. And I hadn't watched it ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was aware of it as a phenomenon, knew what the show was about, thought probably not for me. Cut to friend of mine announcing that he was going to run his own amateur Survivor competition over a weekend just outside of Melbourne, about 2 hours drive. So he recruited a bunch of people, some of whom we didn't know, some were friends, and we spent a full weekend roughing it, playing Survivor. And
sounds like so much fun.
Changed my life.
Because from that you became a Survivor addict.
Yeah, I just started binging. Binge watching like all of the American seasons, the good ones. And I'm watching the Australian Survivor season at the moment and loving it. It's really, really good.
How far in are we? Are we getting towards the end?
We're getting to the pointy end. So I'm actually an episode, two episodes behind.
Oh,
so
no.
I mean, if you know anything, don't tell me.
I can't believe you're
here at all. Yeah, it's a struggle. But beyond that, I have also been watching The Bachelor.
More reality check, yes.
Yes.
This is Australian
That is
Bachelor.
a definite, guilty pleasure.
Sure.
That's The Matchula for anyone playing at home.
The Matchula?
Yeah, Matthew. Matt? Okay. Matthew the Bachelor, Matchula. And he is an aerospace engineer, I believe.
Sure.
Something brainy. Yep. He is a doctor. Although it has emerged that I don't think he's doing anything related to space at the moment. He's working for like Westpac or something as a data analyst. There's been a little bit of controversy around that.
Flippenberg is Hungry Jackson.
But my prediction with him is that he's trying to be the next like Bondi vet of science.
Oh.
Because he's like super handsome. He's using this to build his profile and he'd like to become like handsome science guy of Australian TV.
Sure. Bill Nye, but
Bill
handsome.
Nye the science.
Young handsome. Well, Bill Nye, not saying Bill Nye is handsome, but he's
conventionally handsome.
He's not the Bachelor handsome, though.
Not the Matchelor,
Not the Matchelor. And so you're enjoying that season too?
More for the discussion that happens around it and all of the... I listened to Rosie Waterland's podcast, Just the Gist, where she does a recap. So her friend who hasn't watched it, she basically recaps the two episodes to him.
That's a good idea.
It's really fun, tongue in cheek, and love Osher Ginsberg. It's my partner won't even be in the same room while I'm watching it. I have to like headphones in just by myself.
You're not watching The Block as well?
Oh no.
Things are blowing.
I would never stoop so low.
Based on all the ads I've seen, it's drama central there. All right, we should get into the episode proper. Let's get to our spoiler-free review of Big Little Lies, Season 1.
Let me clue you in.
Season in review.
Big Little Lies is an American drama television series based on the novel of the same name by Leanne Moriarty. Created by David E. Kelly and directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, it premiered on HBO on February 19th, 2017. Big Little Lies tells the story of five women in Monterey, California, who become embroiled in a murder investigation and boasts a stellar cast, including Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Shailene Woodley, Laura Dern, Zoe Kravitz, Alexander Skarsgård, and Adam Scott. Critically acclaimed, the series garnered several accolades, including 16 Emmy Award nominations and won 8, including Outstanding Limited Series and Acting Awards for Kidman, Skarsgård, and Dern. Season 1 consists of 7 episodes, each coming in at around 51 minutes, and took us approximately 5 hours and 55 minutes to watch. Despite being originally billed as a miniseries, HBO renewed the series for a second season. So, how familiar were you with the source material before going into watching Big Little Lies? Have you read the book? Have you read any of, is it Leanne Moriarty's other work?
Yeah, so what I did, I watched this when it came out, and then I went back and I read the book, partly because my sister insisted that I do so. This is an Australian book set in Australia.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting about this as well, is trying to, as someone who hasn't read the book but understood that, think about what might have crossed over well, what might be different. There's about guns in this a little bit, which obviously has got to be different in Australia versus the States, but go on.
There's an argument to be made that this could have been a great opportunity for Australia to tell an Australian story and even seeing Nicole star in it, I think, certainly from my sister's... A couple of times
slip out of her accent as well.
Oh, come on.
It happens. It's in there.
We'll talk about that.
We will.
Just as a bit of a missed opportunity for Australia to do something really high concept, but high budget and glossy and... add to Australia's kind of resume, I suppose.
I'm trying to think of like Australian shows that have had a similar sort of feel to them. And the one that comes to mind straight away is The Slap.
Yes. And I made that comparison as well mentally. I think that there's a lot there that's similar in terms of like the parental tension.
Totally.
And like an incident.
It's like a more higher profile, higher class of person version of The Slap. Slaps, I think there's like a few different demographics in there.
Yes.
There are some, there actually, now that I think about it again, thinking about the miniseries, there were definitely people who were more higher up socioeconomically and then some lower down.
Yeah, so whereas this is very much wealthy, white, affluent people, bar
Jane.
Jane, obviously.
How, this idea that they're going to a public school though...
We'll talk about that.
That's not right. But go on.
Reading the book was really lovely, actually, because it did kind of reinforce that the show had interpreted the text really.
Oh, that's cool.
Beautifully. And then I've rewatched it in preparation for tonight, which was another experience again.
Sure.
So it's fresh.
Very good. Can you give us, please, Hannah, your spoiler-free review of Big Little Lies Season 1?
I sure can.
Thank you.
Big Little Lies is a beautiful, lush melodrama that excels in both story and aesthetics. Its performances are strong and it boasts an incredible ensemble cast of women whose stories are compelling and real. There is a strong pulse and forward momentum to this show's plot, sometimes to its detriment. However, our moments of insight into characters' experiences help retain the emotional truth and humanity of the story, and it's ultimately this that what makes the season so impactful and enduring. This could easily have been an escapist, cliche soap opera devoid of proper meaning. It's obscenely wealthy and white.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the Californian setting is certainly escapist in that sense. However, its focus on women and their traumas, insecurities, and strengths in all their complexity make this an insightful and deeply moving piece of TV.
Very well put. I 100% agree with everything you said. There's a lot going for Big Little Lies. We already compared to The Slap. I sort of written down here, it's The Slap meets Real Housewives. And at first, I was thinking to myself early on, I'm finding it hard to give a crap about these rich white people. It's just very little, you look at their lives and go, why should I be so interested in what's going on here? But it's the way that the show slowly sort of like peels away the layers and we get some very, very rich, traumatic, interesting stuff underneath. It's a sharp, small town murder mystery where you don't know the victim or the killer, with an equally, if not superior, social thriller attached. And as you said, it's a fantastic showcase for women, female characters, and both, and obviously the women in particular who are putting in their performances in this show. So we've got obviously Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Laura Dern, bring some gigantic star power to this HBO short series.
Alexander Skarsgård.
Yes, exactly right. And while they stand out, and I think Nicole Kidman in particular smashes it, although I did make a little barb at her accent earlier, the whole cast, and Alexander Skarsgård is an excellent example, are great from start to finish, including, I thought, the kid child actors. They're asked to do a fair bit.
They are.
And the kid that plays Ziggy, for instance.
Yeah, I looked him up. He's young Sheldon. Sheldon.
Yeah, I know. Mm. I only know because he looks, I'm sorry, Jasmine, he looks exactly like my niece. He looks like a boy version of my niece Jasmine. But he's great in this. He's very, very natural and like watchable. I think all the kids pretty much are good.
They do an excellent job. Really, really good casting.
I love the direction from Jean-Marc Vallée as well. It's a very similar, I think, in like things like the use of music reminds me of Sharp Objects a lot.
Absolutely. The diegetic
sound once again. Uh-huh. Using music. Gotta so in that, it. I think she's using, is it her iPod? Or?
Yeah, mainly from Chloe.
Yeah. And they, well, Maddie's Chloe daughter. In this does a lot of that. But just in general, like anytime music comes in, there's always a diegetic source. That's always fun. I think the music is actually something that's really interesting. We'll talk about in spoilers. There's a really interesting use of like quick cuts to show like internal thought processes as well. Sometimes fantasy, sometimes.
But sometimes to the landscape
memory,
as well.
Sometimes the landscape. There's a lot of use of like. I love just how many shots of the main characters in cars, particularly through rearview mirrors there are.
And that bridge.
And that bridge. It's a great use of the landscape and the setting, definitely.
I almost thought it was like The Slap crossed with a Tim Winter novel crossed with The OC.
Sure. Yeah. I can see that.
And the actress who plays Jane actually played Marissa Cooper's younger sister in The OC. So... California, here we come.
California. The seven episodes is an interesting number, but those 7-hour-ish long episodes, you could argue that this could maybe have worked as a movie as well, but I think that extra time we get really allows the audience to ruminate in the secret lives of these families. There's stuff I can't wait to talk about in spoilers.
Totally.
I think it handles its themes and its stories really, really well. I think there's one... I think most of the stories and the characters are interesting. There's one storyline in particular that I think is so well handled, is so compelling and important as well as a story. I can't wait to talk more about that. And the show has great propulsion, I was getting more invested with every episode right up until the very end. Overall, I thought it was an excellent series. I completely understand the hype around it.
Yep.
Based on what I've heard about season two, I'm looking forward to it and also wondering what exactly that is.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, at this point, really enjoyed Big Little Lies season one. What would you give this out of 5 stars, Hannah?
I think the first time I watched it, I was like, 5. Oh my gosh, sure. This is incredible. Second time around, I started to see a few more things and I was a bit more objective. So sure. I was kind of sitting on a 4, 4.5. I think I'm going to give it a 4.
Cool. I'm going to give it a 4.5 on my first viewing. I was like tempted to give it a 5 to some degree. It's, yeah. There's a couple of things, a couple of elements I'm looking forward to talking about how important or how where they should be included or not. As far as I'm aware, some of them are from the books, but they feel a little bit superfluous and not necessary in the show.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to talking about that in spoilers as well. But overall, I thought it was like stellar cast, really well written, fantastic performances, beautifully shot, compelling. Like, as I said, got more invested as the show went on. Yeah, really, really fantastic. Great work from HBO. Before we dive into spoilers, we'd like to remind everyone that if you enjoy what we do here, we'd really appreciate you sharing the podcast with others who you think might also enjoy listening. We also appreciate your positive reviews on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. But right now, let's talk spoilers.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places using the same old lines? maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're now entering the spoiler zone.
Spoiler warning. On this episode, we'll be discussing everything that happens in season one of Big Little Lies. Before listening any further, we recommend watching all of Big Little Lies up to this point. If you've not yet done so, proceed with caution. There are spoilers ahead.
You have been warned.
Deep dive.
It's cool to know other people think about this stuff too.
Hannah, you want to start this off with a bit of a content warning?
Yeah, content warning, trigger warning. I just think that there is a lot in this show that's really explicit around sexual violence, domestic abuse, emotional abuse that could be quite sensitive for some people. I kind of put myself in that camp, honestly. Mm-hmm. So if that's really hard for you, maybe just go in cautioned. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well said. Before we get started, and we will get to that storyline, which is obviously the Celeste and Perry storyline, as we get going. As someone who's read the book and has now watched the show twice, you said it was a fairly faithful adaptation.
Yeah, bar a few changes. Yeah.
Were there anything, I'm going to say spoilers for the book here for anyone who might be worried about that. Was there anything that stands out that was different, changed, removed, anything like that from the book versus the miniseries?
What, okay, so the main one would be definitely Maddie's affair.
Yep.
That was not in the book.
Okay.
And I can see why they put that in as a device for Maddie, but also for like some tension in her marriage with Ed.
I was going to say, otherwise I think that might have, yeah, without that,
it
I'm
also
not sure.
provides Celeste an opportunity to exercise her independence and try and re-enter her career or dip her toe back in and enjoy herself in that moment where she goes and represents the play at the
Avenue Q. Was she not doing that in the
No, I don't think so. Like not from what I can remember.
Sure.
Yeah. Didn't I mean she worked for the local theatre and there was that kind of status anxiety for her where she was surrounded by these high powered women and she was, you know, in a part time position and wasn't doing something as glamorous as, you know, for example, Renata, who in the show, I think at the start at pick up and drop off, she says something like, oh, just joined the board of PayPal. What was I thinking? Like, just casually, among all the other things. No, I think most other things were in there.
Cool. So the one element of the show that stands out, as far as I'm aware, because my girlfriend Steph has read the book.
Yep.
She's been watching it with me, though. She had to sort of get ahead of her in the end. But she was saying... Well, I was saying, I asked the question, how necessary were these cutaways to the parents being interviewed, sort of...
The Greek chorus.
The Greek chorus,
the show.
Exactly, right? And it was, so it's part of the books, is that correct? That they are...
I don't remember that being a part of the books. On the rewatch, that was part of what took me out of it a little bit. And I just imagined what the show would be like if those were withdrawn completely. Because I love all the cutaways to the crashing waves. And I think that punctuates things quite nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Greek chorus thing, I didn't care who they were. I don't think they added much to the tension because in my opinion, the real investigation and mystery in this show is not the murder that we're brought to in episode one.
Yep.
It's the tensions that arise from these people and their relationships. And the heart of the show for me is really Celeste and Jane.
Yeah, I think the device of like cutting to the parents worked well in the pilot. And then especially as we got later into the season, I was just like, just don't need this anymore because unless there was a point to me, because I was trying to figure out, I was like, what was the point of this? And you said there's that Greek chorus element to it and it adds a bit of levity as well.
I think it was a red herring thing as well where they're trying to
point the finger at everybody.
Certain things and
Sure. And so it ends up just sort of being a reminder that there has been some sort of crime, you know, a murder. It keeps reminding you of that because this is playing out all before that happens. So we get pulled back into the present, you might say, every time that we see one of those interviews. So that sort of works on some level, I guess. And maybe this is the point, but as it went on and I got to know these characters more, I cared less about what the people on the outside thought of them. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And then that last episode when they're at the trivia night...
The trivia night.
It's funny they said trivia
Elvis
night.
And
where was the trivia?
There was a lot of really lovely Elvis renditions.
There was fantastic karaoke, but I didn't see any trivia. I think there was one point I think you heard the principal ask.
Most like, glamorous karaoke I've ever seen in my life.
Again, this is a public school, apparently. Ridiculous.
They do say private school education for a public school price at some point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so then unless the comment was about like these people don't know, you know, this look that everyone has on the outside, this gossip that's going on, has all that drama they create about these people is not reality or like you could make a comment there. I just found it got less and less relevant and less funny or interesting or didn't provide much for me as the show went
on. The insights didn't feel authentic. They felt really contrived and it's like, you don't know these people.
Which again, maybe that's the point.
Maybe.
But it just felt, I guess the tone of it just felt... out of place as we went further and further along.
It took, yeah, I agree. It was really unnecessary, especially towards the end when the tension was really building and we're building to that incredible crescendo of the final two episodes and you're still getting these cutaways.
Yep. You also said just before that the mystery for you is not sort of the hook with this show.
There are other mysteries that I am more engaged with, but what happened on that night is not number one, no.
So, when you were watching the show for the first time, did you pick the ending? Were you engaged enough to even care, like try and pick like who the victim was?
Yeah, like that? I was engaged to try. It's hard to remember exactly what I was thinking or feeling. I was definitely really, really worried when Jane went to see Saxon Banks.
Sure.
That felt like a really dangerous situation for her. I think I did pick it, but I think it doesn't matter.
That was what I was going to get to. Because I like basically the all three reveals we sort of get in the last couple episodes that I thought it was both twins, but that one of Celeste's kids.
Well, you do get that hint where Ziggy's talking about who he plays with.
Sure.
Oh, no, I have lots of friends at school, but Max doesn't make the list.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of actual like almost metatextual hints as well.
Mm.
We see the bite that Amabella gets.
Yes.
And then one of the key things we keep seeing the boys doing is crunching on their cereal.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's such a weird nothing thing except to like they're losing their teeth and stuff like that. None of which has got actually anything to do with them biting. It's
You're
like
right. I didn't see that. But and also Perry, the way he play fights with the kids all the time, he's always like, oh, I'm a dinosaur. And chasing
then
them. And
he will... make Celeste the victim. Like he will always
just became more and more sinister, didn't
it? And like get mummy, right? Yeah. And so they end up like shooting her with Nerf guns and stuff like that. And so I don't know. I'm not so smart. I guess the ending or anything like that. I think the show is really good in that this mystery isn't really a mystery if you're paying attention to what's going on. I think all the clues are there, and it's more that you're waiting for the characters to catch up. But this idea that Jane's worried that Ziggy is somehow like infected with these violent genes from her abuser, whereas we've got the same thing happening with the twins, theoretically, with Celeste, except it's that nature versus nurture argument.
Yeah.
And you look at, obviously, how Perry abuses Celeste. How could the boys have not been influenced by that? So it makes sense that they'd be the bully with Amabella at school. I figured that it was going to be, I hoped at least, it was going to be Perry that was the victim. I actually kind of picked it was going to be Bonnie that killed him as well, though I had no idea in what context or how. There was so many clues pointing to any of the other women, and then they kept kind of including Bonnie in that. And I was like, why are we including Bonnie? Bonnie is barely involved in this story.
Well, actually, no, that's another thing that we do get in the book.
Sure.
We get a little bit more after the fact.
Sure.
And we do find out that Bonnie herself was witness to her own mother's domestic abuse.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So that is what really triggered in her that response.
Yep.
And we don't get that in the show, in this particular.
At least in this first season. and there was, I'm just thinking again of like clues that the show left for us. There was one point where it sort of went through all the, our main characters, all the mothers and women, and they're all having like a moment where they're like thinking about, or it's like flashing to their these weapons they've got. So like Celeste is thinking about the knives and the counter, and Jane's obviously thinking about a gun and
the
so forth.
The flashes are so effective.
And then there was one of Bonnie and a gun that we never see at any other point in the series. And I was like, there's a reason they showed us that.
Yeah.
Like, that's that. What's that for? Therefore, but again, I think the point was the mystery didn't matter. The build up to it, the way the show builds to this moment, is really effective. And it's, I actually thought
there's
for a while.
There's a Vulture article about that, actually, that says Big Little Lies, best investigations are not about murder. And I think they say it really well when they say these scenes of real interrogation, like the chorus ones, don't really work. What does work is this alternate vision of truth-telling and truth-seeking in the therapist's office, led by the calm but unmistakably pointed questions from Robin Weigert's portrayal of Celeste and Perry's therapist.
Oh, those scenes. Oh,
we'll get to that.
Yeah.
The chorus-like collection of minor characters who offer weirdly quippy takes on the school drama are the least interesting version of investigation 100%. Imaginable. They offer no new information, and their universal disdain for everyone involved empties them of any complexity. So
absolutely.
I think that, like, kind of hits the nail on the head for me.
Absolutely. Is there anything in particular you did want to talk about? As someone who's seen it twice through now, what were some observations you made second time through? Was there anything that stood out more the second time round, that you appreciated more the second time round the first time, you think?
I think I was just so looking forward to being back in that Celeste story.
Mm-hmm.
And as painful as all of those scenes were, they are just so masterful.
Yeah.
And they make you feel so much. So I think that's what I really took away from the first time and what I really looked forward to the second time.
Yeah, let's go there then. I think it'd be easy. It does feel like in a lot of ways the show's set up to be either Madeline's or Jane's story, and yet for me, Celeste and Perry's story is the one that I found most compelling throughout. And it really got great for me when they got to the therapy stuff.
Yeah, I asterisked that straight away. Yeah.
And it's... So when we're first introduced to them and their perfect life, and I'm very impressed with the way the show starts in one place, and their like sex life is dangerous and exciting,
but passionate,
and passionate, and there's a part of you that sort of it naively thinks, well, as Celeste says when she goes to therapy, it's like it's complicated,
and it is really complicated for her. It's such a gray area because, she's addicted to that passion and the intensity and the ebbs and the like. The troughs are so low, but those highs are so high, and it's easy to conflate that intensity with love and passion. And that's what's happening for her. Like, it's impossible to disentangle the way that she's feeling about Perry and that amazing intimate connection that they have from all of the other things that are happening that are just completely unacceptable and so damaging. But yeah, there's so much shame. I think that really underlies a lot of what Celeste thinks and feels. She's so ashamed. She at least initially blames herself, and it's really difficult for her to say, take any individual agency. It's all we this and we that, and I, like, the only time she'll take individual agency is to take blame where she shouldn't be taking any at all. It's a beautiful arc. I think it's possibly one of my favorite performances from Nicole Kidman.
I agree. I think she's fantastic in it. And those, again, it comes back to especially being those scenes on that couch with the therapist.
Yeah, phenomenal.
The first time we're there and it's her and Perry.
Yep.
The camera does cut a couple of times back to the therapist, but basically just stays on this sort of like whitish tufa.
Yeah, which it hasn't previously in the show. Like, the camera is static for the first time. It's much more warmly lit. Everything else has been really like cool ocean tones and everything before. we're in this warm, soft space for the first time. It's got all of these like beautiful rainbow refractions of light on their faces. Yeah. And yeah.
But I just found – I was interested. I'm always interested in what when that choice happens to like stick on a basically a single shot. It's because it's always tempting, I think, as a director to try and put energy into the scene. And that's easily done by putting in cuts. Later on in the scene, we see they have these close-ups that they can use, but the director chose not to use them and instead stayed with it. And so there's always the question of, was that always the intention?
Yeah.
Or was that a situation where you get a performance that's so compelling and just like both Alexander Sarsgaard and Nicole Kidman are smashing this scene?
Yeah.
Do you just go, don't mess with it. Just leave it here because this is working without, we don't have to add anything here. We just need to let this play out to the point where I honestly think she loses her accent multiple times in therapy sessions. And while that can be like a little bit distracting, it's
See,
only
I
because I think
it
she's,
all.
I only think it's because the performance she's giving
is so real
and raw. Mm. And it, I don't want to cast aspersions or anything like that. It did make me think about her own troubled history.
What she might be accessing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think I did a little bit of reading on Jean-Marc Vallée and his directing style and the work that Nicole and Alexander were doing together. And Jean-Marc Vallée doesn't rehearse.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they
and
they pretty
much. That sounds kind of dangerous.
Well, it's not to say that there's not you know, care taken with the actors and all of that. There's not to say that there's no support in place for them. And he largely shot chronologically. So Alexander Skarsgård was saying that they shot all of those like gentle, intimate scenes with the kids and those romantic moments. And then they gradually shot more and more of the violent stuff. And he said it was really, really hard for both of them to do. Nicole said she was actually, you know, getting, she did have a double for some of it, but that she was getting physically hurt. But I think in those kinds of scenes where in the therapist's office, they are accessing something really real. It's so beautifully written. All three of them, it just feels, yeah, I keep saying real. It does feel really real.
Totally. The way Nicole's body language changes when she's in that therapy session as well.
With him?
Yeah, in the early one in particular. And there's this sort of like she really tightly wound and closing
and
herself off.
And she's constantly looking to him before she speaks, waiting for, I think... yeah, so we just have a lot of anger that we need some help controlling is what she says to the therapist. I think it's just like tragic how she shares the blame in that moment.
Which is all part of the abuse though. It's like it's there's the, obviously the therapist unwinds a lot of that with her. It sort of it helps to explain that. But there's a bit where he comes – no, sorry. Yeah, he's leaving and he says to – this is back in the home – and Perry says, come with me to Phoenix, wherever it is, right?
Oh, and she's supposed to go to the opening.
Right. And she's like, it's... And I love it when she starts calling it out too, his behavior. It's like, so no matter what happens, you know, I get in trouble if I do something without you.
Yeah.
But you have to leave last minute and then you make this that I'm the disappointment because you now you make... I just want to be romantic.
And
just And just, but that... It's all those levels of manipulation along the way, the making it her fault or finding a way to make him the victim and her the aggressor and whatever it might be. It's just, I think it's, I mean, the thing I kept coming back to is how important this could be for somebody. We were talking about Orange is the New Black a couple of episodes ago and how in some ways this last season's almost been like a guidebook on like if you happen to end up like in a situation where ICE is, you know, taking you and is going to deport you, what your options are legally and stuff like that. And I kind of felt the same way about this. It was
I couldn't
like-
agree more. And look, I don't want to say too much, but I think there are women who have been in my situation and I've been in that room with a therapist. And a lot of people said, oh, a therapist would never say to you, you need to leave this relationship. But they do.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that I was in a relationship that was violent in the way that Celeste's was, but as we can see in the show, it's not just about that. It's about the emotional abuse and the control and it all stems from that insecurity and the power seeking within the relationship. But I went and saw a therapist and described some of the things that I was experiencing, and it really came from a place of all I need to do is just to change the way that I'm communicating. Can you please help me with some strategies to communicate so that I don't upset him so much? What can I do to be different? What can I do to change?
So that's almost identical.
You need to help me.
What Celeste is doing that scene, yeah.
And what the therapist did was to continue to press and say, well, that doesn't sound right. Tell me more about what's happening. And say, well, you know, he doesn't really like me having too many friends, or needs to check my phone, or he needs to know where I am all the time, or if I say this, it's going to upset him. So I need to make sure that I phrase it in the right way. And as I shared more and more, she eventually said, look, you're in an abusive relationship and you need to leave. And I said, well, you can't say that. Like, I'm in love with him, and these are all the amazing things that I could never find with another person. And she's saying, no, and it would be really empowering for you to leave. And it's really hard to hear, but it does happen. And it was just pretty amazing to see that represented on screen, and honestly a bit overwhelming when I watched it the first time. I was just like bawling. It was a lot.
It's incredible how similar that is, like, to like all the things that Celeste is doing in that scene.
Mm.
Like that, yeah, to see that.
But you are so wrapped up in this is love. Like, I love this person, and you're addicted to that high of the dopamine and the ebbs and the flows, and there's chemistry literally to abuse that adds to the complexity of why people stay. And I think that they represented that really, really well.
One of my favorite scenes was her like cleaning and stocking the apartment, stuff like that.
Yes.
And there's like just such no a good dialogue. Feeling. But it's a complex feeling, right? Because it's like, yes, it's a good feeling because she's out, and it's like, but it's like, it's
but
almost
she's not
a sad,
out yet.
No, but it's like a sad realization, right?
Mm.
It's like doing this and being somewhere not with Perry is like the reality that she can,
yeah,
or she should, or that there isn't, like, there's another life that doesn't include this abuse. It's sort of hitting her for the first time.
Absolutely.
And I think you really feel that in that moment. And maybe even just the questions of like, well, what, like when you've been with somebody like that and you have a family, there's got to be a lot of questions about what that next life looks like as well. And just there's a sort of, not terror is not the right word, but an uncertainty there as well. So there's a scariness to it that I think everything about the way that's,
she captures
a shot
that
and
so well.
Her performance captures it. The complexities of those emotions and that thought process she must be going through is a brilliant scene. I was just, wow was the word I wrote down. I was just like, I just love, this is again where I was like, I feel like this is a story you could compact into a movie quite effectively.
Yeah.
But given the beauty of this series is it gives us time to really feel this journey that Celeste is on all the way through it, and yeah, ruminate in it properly, that you get to experience it. Yeah, I don't know. I just dazzled by it. Thought it was so good.
Do you agree that Perry is a good father?
Absolutely not.
Mm.
Not for a second. And that's the bit that when she says that to the therapist, I said to Steph, who was watching it with me, I was like, except it's easy to be the good parent when you're a helicopter parent who comes in and out and just plays with the kids.
Or opposite of a helicopter
parent. Sorry, the flies in and out.
FIFO.
Yeah. The one who just comes home to play with them and be the fun dad and then pisses off again to the other side of the world.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not...
Which is just captured so well in that scene where she's sitting there folding, washing. He comes in and there's Lego everywhere.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't want to live in a pigsty. You need to clean this up. And she's had it. And she just says, why don't you clean it up if it bothers you so much? And that is probably one of the scariest. I mean, there's a few scenes that are really scary, but that made me so angry on her behalf. And you could really feel how scary that would have been for him to do what he did. Like to...
Just the petulant nature of like anytime he gets... Sookie is the word that comes to mind.
Yeah. I mean, he's so insecure and so fragile.
Insecurity
it
is
comes
the heart
back
of
to
all
this
of
fear of like, I think he articulates it in their only that one session that they have together. She could have anyone she wants.
Mm-hmm.
She could look at her. She's beautiful. She could be with anybody and she's with me. I don't feel good enough. And that manifests in this horrific treatment of this person he supposedly loves.
A way of taking control.
Yes, it's always it's all about control.
Because of his insecurity.
Power and control to try and soothe this unsoothable insecurity that runs so, like, I do not know where that comes from. He describes it as sickness.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think the show brings up is this idea of nature versus nurture, right?
Yes. And the parallels with the kids.
Right. And so, another reason he's not a good dad is because think about what his behavior is, how his kids are picking up on how he treats Celeste and then how they're obviously treating Annabella or how Max is doing it, right? And so Celeste keeps saying he would never hurt the kids.
Mm.
He would never hurt the kids. Maybe not physically, but he is hurting them in terms of teaching them these terrible behaviors that maybe will not ever be a massive negative to them, but is going to affect other children poorly and other women poorly. It's going to create only more harm in the world. And I thought that the music in this show as well, just to take a little bit of a detour here, the kids all listen to like...
really great. That's been a criticism of the show.
I think it's a comment.
Yes. Right?
I think it's an extension of this idea that these kids are learning from their parents, right? These kids listen to the music of their parents' generation.
Yeah.
Because they're being directly influenced by what their behavior, by how they interact with one another, and it all comes from their parents, right?
Mm, mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I agree. The kids are listening to stuff that's way too... It's not their ear at all.
I think it's adorable.
It is
especially
adorable.
Especially from Chloe, who I love.
And it makes for a great soundtrack. But it's kind of the show's very, very subtle way, I think, of putting in... reminding you that, like, yeah, they've got this weird taste in music, but where's that come from? Well, it comes from the parents. They learn that from them the same way that Max is learning his behaviors from Perry.
And that even when Jane breaks it to Celeste that Max has been hurting Amabella, and she tries to soothe Celeste by saying, look, they're kids, they hurt each other, they grow out of it eventually. And Celeste says, well, you know, maybe they don't.
Mm.
Maybe they don't grow out of it. And that there's just so much in that, because she really takes it on the chin, that concern, and it would just be so painful to hear that as a parent and then to know what you've experienced and to imagine that could be someone else in the future as well.
And that you're...
how do you even...
that your own son. That's why I know that Meryl Streep is playing Perry's mother. Is that right?
Season yes, two? She is.
And so there feels like... don't say anything. Obviously, you've seen it. I haven't.
A poker face.
Perfect. Poker face. That's what the kids should be listening to.
sure.
There's potential there to maybe express where some of Perry's insecurity comes from, where some of his behavior comes from. If we believe in this nurture is what shapes you sort of thing, and we're looking at Celeste, who is sitting here worried about her kids' violent behavior towards other little girls, will Meryl Streep's character have a similar worry about Perry, or will we get some insight into where his insecurities and need for control comes from? And I'm looking forward to finding out. And I
hope
these are
all great questions, Brod, that nobody has the answers to.
Excellent.
Well, certainly not in this room.
Was there anything else about the Celeste and Perry stuff you wanted to talk about? I think we've covered it pretty well.
Oh, man, I could talk about it forever.
Seriously, though, it is like, it's that good.
You know that scene? Oh, you know what? Mm. When after she's made that plan with the therapist, or... I think it's just after she's communicated to the therapist that she has had a moment where she thought that she might die.
Yep.
And the therapist saying, you need to leave. And she's like, okay. And you see her scoop the boys up from school and head straight to the airport.
Yeah.
And the first time I watched it, I was like, oh my God, she's doing it.
Yeah.
And she's actually rushing to meet him at the airport. And that reunion between the two of them is so... you hate it. But it's... so genuinely, there's so much chemistry between the two of them.
It's part of why it works, though, the whole thing, is that, especially early on, and you sort of are just made to believe that this is just how their relationship works.
And
there's a lot of talk about, like, there's conversations between Ed and Madeline about like their sort of sexless marriage versus what Celeste and Perry have got. And there's a jealousy there and it makes you think that that's right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there's so many fascinating conversations around all that. That it's, I don't think, like, obviously the way that Perry abuses Celeste is terrible from the beginning. But it's funny how the show almost puts you in Celeste's mindset to begin with.
Yeah.
It's exciting and
exhilarating. You're there with her.
Yeah.
But yeah, we should move on because I could talk about it forever, but we need to talk about other things.
There was one other thing I was going to say, which was I also love just the dread that happens in the last episode.
Oh, when
he finds the text message or whatever it is.
Voicemail or something from the property manager.
Which, first of all, just the fact that he's like, it's just another level of control when he's looking at her phone.
Her having too many friends. Yeah. And of course he's checking her phone.
Yeah.
And oh, the deadpan where he was like, will that be okay with you, honey, if they come in and do the smoke alarms?
Then when he takes off instead of going to the valet.
Oh, my God.
And he just like, I was like, I'm pretty sure I know how this ends. I'm pretty sure he is dying. But boy, you just can't help but not feel complete dread for Celeste in that moment. And when Renata shows up at the window, thank Christ. Just the relief that comes over you.
Yeah.
It's so important. It's so compelling, that storyline. I don't feel like any of the other storylines really come close to me. I think Jane's storyline... Let's talk about Jane's storyline for a bit. Jane and Ziggy. I really do love that storyline in terms of Jane as the outsider coming into this community is a great sort of entry point for the audience, like the audience surrogate in a way.
Just thought of another difference in the book. She comes to Monterey to because she knows that her... rapist lives there.
That Saxon Banks, whatever, is actually there.
Yeah.
Right.
Not for a fresh start. Well, ostensibly for a fresh start. That's what she tells her family.
Yeah.
But really, she has moved there because she knows that's where he is.
Gotcha. Did you think that Perry was her abuser?
Not initially.
Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of crept in on me a little bit.
Sure.
That moment of recognition, though, on the top of the stairs, between all of them, the way they see, the women see the way that she's looking at Perry and the way Perry's looking at her,
mm-hmm.
that is amazing. Yeah. Like, yeah, what a moment.
I think the show gives you a lot of clues as to it being
him. Go on.
Well, the main thing was when she tells her story to Madeline, like they vividly show like the abuse. And it's so similar to the first time that we see, I think it's the first or maybe second time, one of the early sex scenes between Perry and Celeste. Like, it's very similar. The way that he's having sex with her is so similar.
Mm.
And it's like, it was hard not for me to draw that connection. And so I never believed that the guy she was chasing down, Saxon...
A poor
thing, whatever.
Interior designer.
I was like, it occurred to me that she'd never spent time around Perry. Like, he was just never there because he's always away.
And it's the same in the book. They just never cross paths.
She said it would be, you know, I'd hear his voice and I'd know.
Mm.
And so that moment when she just hears, she finally sees him. Oh man, so good. But yeah, that storyline's her relationship with Ziggy is fantastic, and that. Yeah, the pressures of coming to a new place, of feeling like the outsider already, of having your son be accused of choking a little girl, of trying to navigate these extremely powerful
I'm sorry, women but like, what is the school doing as well? Like,
well, as a teacher, I'm fascinated in your perspective on this.
Okay, so here's a hint. On the first day of prep, maybe don't call a mini symposium with all of the parents and demand that abuser step forward.
Yeah.
That would never happen. Also, just quietly, all we ever see these kids do in school is sit quietly in their spots learning to sing the school song. Like
the Otter Bay song, whatever it is. Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't sing it off the top of my head. But she just like walks around all of them while they're singing. It was so bizarre. She was that scene where she meets up for drinks with Jane. I was like, mate, you are cooked. You are asking for trouble. It's so unprofessional.
I do think that's a deliberate part. Like, At some point, you have to just believe this school is not very good at handling the situation.
No, they suck.
Yeah, they suck. And they let... Like, when Renata shows up when the principal is having a meeting with Jane, and then they somehow just let... He's just like, yeah, you know what? Come in. This is a good idea.
This is great. Like,
what are you doing, you idiot? This is a terrible idea.
Well, Renata kind of stormed. Like, there's no stopping her, really.
He definitely could have gone...
He was an enabler, yeah.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, we're all here to talk about the same thing, so I may as well. Look, I won't. Yeah, they exist.
But yeah, no, that I mean, a single mother story is compelling enough, I think. And my sister is a single parent with the niece that looks exactly like Ziggy, oddly enough. And I have a lot of sympathy for those sort of storylines, how hard that is. But yeah, I do find that quite compelling. The stuff with... I just don't feel like I don't feel like we spend enough time with Jane in some... for a main character, maybe just everything is overshadowed by Celeste and Perry.
Maybe,
to some degree, that's just so
compelling.
What about
like her running scenes and those really intense flashes she has and those moments where she's like screaming and the flashes that she has imagining herself throwing herself off the cliff or... those alternate realities or futures that she's having in those moments. I don't know.
I do like her fantasies. I think they're very interesting. And again, it's a really great use of that like flash cutting.
He does that really well.
Really well. It's really, really effective how it's used, just always or mostly audioless. They're just like these fantasies playing out. Very quickly, you understand that it's just
very
internal.
Visual. He understands the importance of showing, not telling.
Absolutely. Yeah, I found it good. Maybe it's also because every other character has someone else to talk to, and she mainly just gets to talk to Ziggy, or she's talking to Madeline and Celeste, like,
yes,
at the cafe. There's...
Blues.
I can't even remember. No idea. Tom, is that the name of the guy?
Yeah, Tom.
Tom's sweet.
One of the few men.
That's actually...
Hashtag not all men.
Not Tom.
Hashtag not Tom.
Whereas, like, and maybe, again, just Madeline's such a bigger personality. She really takes over. I was like, I feel like Jane's meant to be, like, because she's our audience surrogate, she's meant to be the lead in this story.
Did you enjoy Madeline?
I do. I really enjoy Madeline.
She's
so
fun.
She is really good.
Complex as well. It's not all gregarious, bubbly,
no,
obnoxious.
Super flawed in a million and one different ways.
Yeah.
I think...
And Adam Scott, did you buy their chemistry?
Well, it's that... It's a middling amount of chemistry.
Well, yeah.
Which is why
did you buy their... I shouldn't say chemistry. I should say relationship.
Yes.
Because I totally...
I think it's very familiar.
It's very plausible.
Totally.
Adam did such a good job of being this really endearing, patient partner.
Yeah. When he and at times
but
he wasn't,
but also flawed
though,
as well.
Totally. And at times he wasn't patient. And I thought that was very true. Too. Yep.
Mm.
I think Reese Witherspoon is really good at playing these sorts of characters.
She was drawn to it, wasn't she?
I think of Flick in Election. Have you seen Election?
No.
Oh, so good. You need to see Election.
Okay.
Brilliant.
I'll do it.
It's about a high school, like, going for class president sort of thing. And she plays this extremely competent and just like a pushy.
She's
student.
A pusher. She pushes people.
So she's amazing in it. So it's her and Matthew Broderick. It's really, really good. Definitely check it out. But it's the same sort of character. She just plays them so well. And I suppose I don't even know the character's name, but Legally Blonde.
Elwoods.
Similar sort of like vibe going.
But this is probably the most three-dimensional version of that she's played.
Yes. In what sense?
A greater vulnerability, I suppose.
So they added in the affair into this version of the story.
Yeah.
How did you find that?
I didn't even think it was that showcased her vulnerability. It's
sure.
more her relationship with Abigail and her sadness at not being able to maintain that closeness and be that person for her. But simultaneously, you can see how she's pushing her away. I think mainly relationship with Abigail, relationship with Ed, but also Nathan as well. Like... her inability to kind of leave that relationship behind, to not be able to let go. Oh, you know what? That scene between Nathan and Ed.
With the first time they interact where it's
when
they start threatening each other.
Ed like rocks up on his little bicycle,
yes,
with his helmet on, and Nathan's just such a penis. Like, I'm sorry, but
I love that scene. I think it's so funny.
Me too.
Because I think in a weird way, it's like showcases how boring the men's storylines are.
Yeah.
It's like, it just comes down to this penis like length contest. Like, yeah. It's just like, it's I'm gonna beat you up.
It's like, fuck off.
And then even like when we get to the karaoke at the end, and he's like, Ed's rendition is amazing of like his song. And then it's like, well, what's Nathan's gonna be like? Mm. And he's great too. I'm like,
everyone was great.
Everyone's great.
But Nathan would never be with Zoe Kravitz's character. That just seemed totally unbelievable to me. He was like wearing a leather wristband and like, what is happening?
I had a hard time. Nathan is probably the one character who I just didn't find compelling or interesting. He just seemed so basic the entire time.
Yeah, he's nothing.
He's a nothing. But I did kind of, I love his reaction when Ed rides off and he's just like, he's so like frazzled, like the adrenaline's running. He's meant to be like, so, punch him in the face, this little nerd that's like threatened him. Yeah. And it's just that's hilarious, that reaction.
Really funny.
It's really funny. And then every time there's a line he has, I'm gonna show him who's evolved, kick his cultural ass. And just like this, it's so basic and just like chest thumpingly dumb. He's such an idiot, Nathan. You want to talk? Sorry, we got a little bit ahead of ourselves with Jane, I think.
I just think that Jane is such a good mum. She's so gentle. She doesn't talk down to her son.
Mm-hmm.
She's just really loving. And that was a child who came into the world under really difficult circumstances and was met with such love and care from her. And
that choice is always, that's a really interesting part of her character, is to keep Ziggy, yeah. I guess. And it's never really explored as to what her reasons were for that. It could be
anything,
or so many things.
Yeah, she loves him, and I think he knows that he's loved, and even though that there's that difficulty there that kind of is brought to her head with the family tree project, and he's got a lot of anger through not understanding something, and that's so true to being a child. I think the children are written really well for the most part. You believe that they're kids, and they're allowed to be really playful with each other in the moments that you see them. And yeah, they just come across as naturally acting kids. There was one scene with...
I can't get over how good they are.
They're so good. There was this one scene with Jane and Ziggy. I think he's having like an ice cream on the beach, and then they're playing ball or something, and the ball hits him in the face.
Yeah, he starts crying.
And oh, I'm like, that is a real cry. You can't act that. And I genuinely think that he got clocked in the face, and she's so sweet to him. She comes over, oh, there's no blood. And then she's making the joke about, should we call an ambulance? Do you need an ambulance? No, you're going to be all right. Okay.
That's a great scene.
Yeah.
And at the end of that tour, he's like, the last time we had pizza and sat on the beach, we were moving.
Yeah, that's right.
Very insightful kid as well.
Yeah.
And what about Renata?
Renata's interesting because she's obviously got a lot of her own baggage around being bullied.
Mm.
And she is projecting that onto Amabella big time. So she responds in a really intense way to any suggestion of bullying, and asserts herself really strongly now as well. And she goes on these crusades because I will not be bullied. I will not allow my daughter to be bullied and treated, and it's maybe not said the way that I was, which is kind of, I think, what she is saying. I didn't like Renata much at all initially, but she really grew on me.
Yeah, I really like, there's that scene where Jane comes to apologize for basically taking her eye out almost. That's a bit of an overreaction too, but anyway, that's a great scene.
I love that she had the eye patch.
She was way too far away to realize. I was like, she's going to have an eye patch on when she gets it. Yeah, she does. That's great. What a drama queen. And she apologizes, and just that empathy that she shows to like, I can totally understand, you know, your instincts to protect Amabella here. And can you, and then asks her to sort of like, appreciate this from her perspective, trying to protect Ziggy. And they're like, they come to some sort of arrangement.
Yes.
And then they start like talking in the car park, and they're like, you know, they're not there yet, but they're amicable about it. And then just the way overall that all the women end up working together at the end of this, that they're so much stronger, obviously protecting each other from this evil around them, basically. It evolves quite naturally, but it does mean Renata has to be the villain for so long, basically, in the piece. And it kind of makes me look forward to, I'm hoping they've got stuff of her to do in season two. And Laura Dern is just such a great actress.
Yes.
I want to know spend more time with Renata in a way that I can get to know her and appreciate her, I guess.
A bit more,
because it does happen by the end of it. But you're like, oh, I feel like I've wasted all this time. Maybe a second watch would be make that more interesting, I guess.
Yeah, I appreciated her right from the start, second time around. Maybe through those moments that we get later in the series.
Because she's not just the villain with Ziggy. Season? She's the villain with Avenue Q as well. Like, she's just this...
Avenue Q. She is. She's on this moral crusade.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. And she is that heel, I guess, for Maddie, mm-hmm. more than anything else.
That was...
And a device for Celeste to get on out there.
We shouldn't go back to the Celeste thing. But that bit, that scene in the car with her and Maddie where she's just crying because she realizes how much she loves doing this. And
she says, it's not enough for me to be a mum. I'm sorry, but it's not. And that's okay.
To have that discussion, it was very cool. And just also, it was just another level of, like, manipulation that we're stripping away. We're we didn't necessarily know this until this moment. Maybe she'd forgotten how much she loved doing this, but she's been convinced that she shouldn't be doing it.
Kept woman, yeah.
The way he talks about, like, oh, you got so stressed out when you were working, we couldn't have kids, and just makes her, she's to blame, fuck him.
I don't know.
So well
masterful. Conceived. Alexander. Damn it.
You want to talk about the ending as well, though?
Yeah. I mean, just those... The final episode builds so beautifully to that final crescendo at the end where... So, you see all of them look at each other and there's that moment and Perry is cornered. He's like an animal that's cornered. He's literally got nowhere else to go, and then it cuts and we go to the future. And the fallout, you see, like, all the police and everything and that... hazy, confusing time. Then right at the end you come back and this is intercut. I mean, it's juxtaposed with the calm and the joy of, like, all of the women being together on the beach and this is, like, a really safe and gentle space. But that final silent montage that's, like, intercut with the waves crashing against the rocks with Perry's final moments where he's bashing Celeste and the women absolutely come for him. It's just pure instinct at that point, it seems, and it's amazing to watch. Like, in that moment, it seems to be saying, you will not do this to her, but more broadly, I think it's women saying, you cannot do this to us. Mm-hmm. It's this amazing, empowering moment of the women protecting women.
Yeah.
And Bonnie ends it all just, like, with a push and a scream. It's just power and it's rage and it's... In that moment afterwards, it's shock from all the women as well. And the waves, like, smashing against the rocks. I'm like, yeah, this is, like, metaphor for, like, smash the patriarchy, which is, like, so lame. But I think that's definitely how it feels.
Smashing against the stairs, smashing, maybe.
Yeah. That's better. I like that.
Think of it that way. It's a very interesting ending. It's interesting because for a while there, it seems like we might not get resolution as to who killed Perry. Because we obviously get the reveal that Perry is the victim. And you're like, cool, excellent. That's why I wanted to be. And then they're doing the interviews and no one's saying anything, you know. It's like, oh, maybe he just slipped.
Interviews, but yeah.
Sure. But you kind of, I was like going, well, maybe we're not going to find out. And maybe that would be a cool way to end it. So when it's revealed that it is Bonnie, how does that work for you that Bonnie ends up being sort of like the murderer, quote unquote?
I wonder whether including some of those things from the book might have helped you understand and appreciate. I just don't think they gave enough to Bonnie, to be honest.
I 100% agree with that. I think Zoe Kravitz is really good in it too, and yet she seems to always be like, I thought Laura Dern to some degree was sort of on the outside, but Bonnie is more
and
so.
And to be the only woman of colour in that ensemble cast, it's a little bit rude. Like, she had some really meaty stuff in the book and you took that away from her.
That's so, I don't understand that for a second. I didn't know she was bigger in the book. I was like, oh, maybe the whole idea, like, it's kind of like a red herring, right? Because you look at, like, how this could have been Celeste that did this, or how this could very easily have been Jane, obviously, because she seems to have that gun with her at all times, all that sort of stuff. And so for it to be Bonnie is sort of a twist, but it doesn't quite feel earned. And again, it makes me want... They didn't know they were getting a season two when they did this.
They didn't want a season two initially. So Jean-Marc Vallée said, this is it. This is what we want it to be. I don't want a season two. And then he changed his mind after it was decided. He didn't direct season two.
I was going to say he didn't direct it, but we're going to talk about this when we get to season two because he didn't direct it, but he came in later and helped to cut it, I believe.
Yeah, well, editing's his thing. Mm. He's an editor, I think, first and foremost.
There's a lot of controversy around that move as well. But we'll get to that when we get to season two, which I have not seen. So I'm
looking forward to you seeing it, because I feel like many of your questions will be answered.
Okay, good. That's good to know. But the ending is excellent. And that, again, when we're talking about, like, it's great to see these sort of just women come together, the stuff with Maddie and...
It's so satisfying.
Jane and Renata. And then, yeah, to see them on the beach at the end and, like, protecting Bonnie in that. Like, it feels like they're sort of around her, not just at the top of the stairs, but on the beach at the end as well. There's this, like, you know, we're here for you now.
Exactly, yeah.
As well, it's very cool. And they're just... Yeah, it's an excellent ending. Although I don't think I needed even, like, especially if they weren't expecting a season two, the whole, like, binoculars bit at the end with the clicking light, I was like, that's on the nose. You didn't need that bit.
Any last words?
Final thoughts.
That's why you always leave a note.
Do you have any side notes, Hannah?
Side notes.
No one ever does. It's always just me.
No. I think I do. I think that I did want to say a little bit more about this primary school teacher.
Oh, yes. How she handled things?
It was about, you know, that little class mascot?
Yeah, the hippo.
Yeah, Harry the hippo.
Who just disappeared and then...
It's totally a thing that we do, though, right? So, we send, like, a toy home with every member of the class, and then they can take photos and journal about its adventures. In the book, Ziggy loses Harry the hippo.
He did in the show as well.
Oh, he did too. Yeah.
But nothing ever really came of
it. But oh my God, the fallout from that in the book.
That's what I was waiting for.
Yeah.
I was just assuming it was going to be the next level of like persecution on Ziggy.
Yeah, and it was. But I can totally relate to that. I've had like, you do not want anything to happen to the class mascot. Absolutely not. These kids, to them, like... It's alive, essentially. So,
I only had one side note,
and
it was just a tiny moment in the finale that I thought was hilarious, was when Tom shows up with Jane.
Yeah.
And Jane, he goes, hey, do you want me to get you a drink? She's like, yeah, I'll have this. And then Maddie goes, oh, can you get me one too? And it's like, she's still in the cafe. It's like, can you just get me another drink, please, Tom? Because this is the only way I know how to interact with you is to order a drink from you. And the way he looks at her is just like, yeah, sure. Very funny. Did you have a least favorite or favorite and favorite episode? Let's go with least favorite first.
Oh, least favorite. That's hard. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
I'll give you mine.
Okay, you go.
My one is episode one, Somebody's Dead.
Yep.
Only because I actually started this series three times. Like, okay. I've tried to start it multiple times. I never paid it past episode one. I don't think it's actually a bad episode at all or a bad pilot.
But it didn't grab you.
No, it just has the hard task of being about, it's just all about setup, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't quite have that punch. And like, if you think about how that episode is structured, it's a lot of being introduced to these women on the way to dropping off their kids. And then we have the incident. And then it's each of them back home talking with their husband. And then... It's kind of the episode ends and we have a bit of a montage that sort of is like a, not a premonition, but it's like setting up for the rest of the series. It's almost like a preview of what's to come in like little flashes.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It just didn't, it's missing that punch. It's missing every other episode after that, I think, builds on it really well. And so it's hard for me to think of any other episode being, none of them are bad, but it was my least favorite, I think. It just doesn't have as much going on for it as the others do.
Sure. Yeah. I think I kind of felt that way a little bit about episode six, the one that came before the final.
Interesting.
Episode. Yeah. Maybe it was just where I was at when I was re-watching it.
Sure.
That's the eye gouging episode. What else happens? Another counseling session. I think it just lacked a little bit of pace or momentum or something for me there.
Gotcha.
Maybe I was just really amped to get to the final episode because that's definitely my favorite episode the reasons we have discussed.
Just the way it ends, the momentum building into it.
Yeah. Sure. I think it's a really beautifully crafted episode. But if I had to choose another one, I think it would be episode five, Once Bitten.
Sure.
That's where Celeste is first challenged to confront what Perry's doing.
Yep.
That's when Amabella's bitten and Ziggy's blamed and you have the car accident with Maddie and Joseph. I think just a lot of things come to a head.
Car accident. Yeah. Does that wouldn't happen
in
the book.
No, because she doesn't have the affair.
Yeah.
But it's also got the Lego scene in it as well. And I think.
Oh, sure.
It's just a lot of emotional intensity in that episode that I really loved.
Just because now I think about the car accident, the Maddie affair stuff I think is great for Matt. I agree with you, actually. Her relationship with her daughters is more interesting.
Yeah.
Overall. And I like her relationship with Ed.
The thing with, like, Jonathan or whatever his name is, Yawn. Like,
yeah, he's Yawn. That's the problem. He's not really much of a character. He's just there to be handsome, have the affair, be a shit about it.
Yep.
And then have the wife be suspicious.
Tori
be suspicious. Yeah. Yeah, it feels added on, doesn't it? Anything about... Although, like, Reese Witherspoon kills it with that. I'm going to surprise you here. My favorite episode was episode 6.
Oh.
Burning Love. I think the more great therapy stuff in there.
I do love that.
I think what I've written is some real talk happening this episode. Thematically, it's up to its neck. So, like, basically, for me, it was building so well into the last episode. It was like it taken everything that come before it, was really getting into the meat of it so we could get to the resolution and conclusion that was happening in the last episode. And I was just like, I was just there for it. I was really happy with where it was at. Just fully propelling itself into the ending.
Okay.
I liked where it placed all of our characters and then to see that all sort of unfold. Because it's funny, the last bit, the criticism I'd have for the ending, right, is that they're still playing on this, like, whodunit thing.
Yeah.
And, like, there's so many, we keep seeing, like, all the Greek chorus, like, looking over their shoulders at our characters, and it's like, who's going to kill who? It's like, such and such is, Renata's husband has threatened Jane at one point, basically,
yeah,
and sort of Tom, and it's like, is it going to be Nathan and Ed? It's like, we know it's not those things, and that's my... probably my biggest criticism. Like, last episode's great, don't get me wrong. But it's doing...
But they're still playing on it a little bit.
They're just sort of like... it's a little bit coy, I guess. I don't know. It's... Maybe coy's not the right word. It's a little bit trite, maybe is a better word for it. And whereas the second last episode for me did such a good job getting us to that point, I just adored it. Predictions, hopes, concerns. Little bit hard.
I cannot participate.
You cannot. So I'll go through mine. Plenty still to explore, I thought. I can see why you'd be happy with this ending to just be the first season. I think it's great as it is as a standalone. But I am looking forward to what these characters do with this big secret / lie on their hands now. Still potentially some fallout to come for Maddie and Ed. What happens to Celeste now? I'm really fascinated to see sort of what her life is like post-Perry with the boys, being on her own, sort of like trauma doesn't just disappear.
No.
You know, just because Perry's gone doesn't mean his influence on her disappears completely. So I'm fascinated to see what that looks like and how they explore that.
I think it's interesting hearing you say all of those things because you're right, you do get to the end of the season and there are all of these lies that continue they're sustained.
Yeah.
They don't just disappear.
And that's the title still works, right? Like,
it does.
There's this big lie at the end of it still.
But also little ones.
At little ones too. Exactly. What a great title for the show. So clever. I'm hoping they get more to do with Bonnie because Zoe Kravitz and that character deserve it. And obviously looking forward to Meryl Streep. And as I said, I hope we get to explore, if what I understand is correct, Meryl Streep is playing Perry's mother, then there is just so much that we could learn about Perry and so much they can build on the existing themes of like how parents influence their children's behavior, that there's lots to dive into there, I hope. So I'm looking forward to it in a big way with a little bit of trepidation because from what I understand, it wasn't received that well this season.
No comment.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Hunting Seasons. You can find more of what we do via our website, huntingseasonspodcast.com. Our logo and design work comes from Sean Kirkpatrick, aka @ShawneeBoyDraws, and our theme song and bumpers from Lucas Heil of Birthday Loyalty Club. Find links to their work in our show notes. You can also find myself, Broderick Gordis, on Twitter @BGordis, BGORDES, Hannah, there you go. You can tell how much I do this as a habit now. Hannah, do you want people to find you online?
I would rather not, but
that's fine.
Thank you for listening to my voice.
Thank you.
Oh, no, actually, yes. I'm going to plug something.
Yes.
Although there's not much on there yet. I did follow through and create Empty Cups of Hollywood.
Oh, yes.
On Instagram.
Yes, I need
You're
to
not gonna
give
get,
you some stuff.
Oh, yeah, please. Submissions welcome. There's not a lot on there at the moment. Followers still welcome. Do need to relocate my password to get back into that account. But I'm excited to build up a little bit of content
Explain
on that page.
To the listeners what it is because I think...
Okay. I think I did talk about this on my Sharp Objects
we
episode.
We might have new listeners.
This is where I patented the idea.
Sure.
Genesis. So really, really, my pet hate, right, in film and TV is visibly empty cups that actors are drinking from that are practically like zero gravitying their way into the sky.
You can just tell there's nothing in them. Could I send you not just empty cups? Could I send you like empty boxes? Like
empty box, love it. Yep, I think it's in the same genre.
Because I reckon there's multiple scenes in The Sopranos. I just need to go back to season one. There are multiple scenes with empty cups and empty boxes.
I have already kind of broadened the genre a little bit as well because the Game of Thrones coffee cup did make it into the... Or I've got like three posts or something. But yeah, if you're interested, that's my main...
And where do you find that again? On Instagram?
Instagram.
At...
Empty Cups of Hollywood.
Empty Cups of Hollywood. Definitely check that out. And thank you very, very much for filling in, coming in and joining us today, Hannah, and for filling in for Damask.
It was my absolute pleasure.
Really, really appreciate you doing this. Next episode is probably going to be a bit of a different one too. The plan is to record an episode reviewing Gravity Falls Season 1 with Lucas Heil. So Lucas Heil, who does our bumpers and our theme song, and probably... If you're up for it, talking about Big Little Lies Season 2 maybe in a fortnight, Hannah.
Love it.
Excellent. Yep. Hopefully, Damask will be back for that one. In the meantime, thank you again for listening. We will see you next time. Bye for now.
Bye. Good night, everybody. Absolutely.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at. Like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.